that allows large teams to work like small teams. Then we had to have larger teams, and then we had to formalize a lot of things. We went into the whole approach of milestones and driving the zero defects at those milestones and the way we did the project estimations. Those are all things that deal with the size of the project teams. Product architectures that reduce interdependencies among teams. Good architecture can reduce the amount of interdependency within even a development group here. Nearly all new product development done on one site. Our all being, with very minor exceptions, here on one site, so that whatever interdependencies exist, you can go see that person face to face, is a major advantage. People working on the same machines they build products for. Our development system and our target system are the same. Some people don't do it that way. A single main development language. People can argue about which is the best developmental language, but we have one. Large capital investments to support people. Our willingness to spend money to buy tools for people. Our giving people an office of their own. Internal use of their own engineering tools. We have control over our tools because we use our own tools. On balance, we have a massive benefit by using our own tools. More than one person who understands the product details. We don't have large bodies of code where just one person has looked at the code and everybody else goes, "Oh my God, the prima donna is the only one who can change this code." Managers who both create the product and make the technical decisions. We don't have non-technical management trying to make technical trade-offs. Quick decision-making on technical versus business trade-offs. We have an ability to get technical business trade-offs made with high speed. If there's some question about it, either the business product unit manager will decide very quickly, or if somebody wants to send an email to me to get me involved in the decision, that'll happen very quickly. An enormous feedback loop from customers. Most people don't get millions of people giving them feedback about their software products. We have this whole group of over 2,000 people in the U.S. alone that takes phone calls about our products and logs everything that's done. So we have a better feedback loop, including the market. Deliberate efforts to learn from past projects. We do good postmortems after the projects and look at what were the source of the bugs. How could the design generate less bugs? And how could the tools generate less bugs? As Microsoft has grown, Gates has faced new problems. He has to study constantly to stay on top of a fast-moving company and industry and to remain knowledgeable about Microsoft's expanding arsenal of products as well as those of competitors. He has to decide every day what to control and what to delegate. To be sure, Gates has able help, although he and other Microsoft managers resist creating large staffs for anything. Gates has only one personal administrative assistant and one technical assistant, hired during the past few years. The technical assistant is generally a young program manager or software developer who holds the job for a year or two. The assistant reviews product ideas and specifications, takes notes in meetings, follows competitors and trade shows, and helps Gates keep track of different projects. Microsoft executives have introduced fairly conventional management systems, but Gates remains closely involved. He presides over program reviews and planning sessions in April and October of every year that set the schedule for rolling out new products and establishing budgets. The October reviews center on 3-year product plans. Each division explains the products it is planning to deliver and any interdependencies with other products. After completing the October review, Microsoft's marketing staff, called product managers, create a sales forecast based on the division's product plans. Detailed budget planning then begins, and managers look at the sales versus budget estimates to determine how these compare with the profit objectives for the company. Based on this analysis, Gates and other top executives determine the employee headcount they want for the fiscal year beginning in July. Gates not only takes an active role in all the significant review and planning sessions, but gives direct advice to the key product units. In general, Gates concentrates on defining strategic new products or new versions of products and keeping a check on development schedules, mainly through product status reports and electronic mail from project team members and managers. He receives short status reports from projects every month. These used to be bi-weekly, and actually reads them. He attends quarterly program reviews for many projects. He writes occasional strategic memos, perhaps 4 or 5 times a year. One he was writing while we visited, his assistant told us, outlined some of the big technical challenges we face and who's going to own particular solutions and what solutions are the right ones from a strategic point of view. Once or twice a year, he goes on think weeks. During these times, he isolates himself and thinks about a particular problem. For example, how to improve customer support, how to get groups to cooperate more, or what a product should look like 5 years in the future. Gates also tries to get the biggest bang for the buck from the time he spends. The products that comprise 80% of our revenue, I choose to understand very, very deeply. This means that he spends most of his time following such key applications as Office and its Word and Excel components, as well as Windows. He also closely follows new high-growth areas, such as multimedia and online information services and products. Project status reports. Each software product has a corresponding project status report. Project teams send these each month to Gates and other top executives, as well as the managers of all related projects. They are a key mechanism for communicating between projects and top management. Gates usually responds to the relevant managers or developers directly by electronic mail, then uses the information he gathers for the formal program reviews. These reports also communicate target schedules, which project members set themselves. As Gates explained, I get all the status reports. Right now, there might be 100 active projects. The status reports contain the schedule, including milestone dates, and any change in the spec, and any comments about, hey, we can't hire enough people, or, geez, if this OLE, object linking and embedding, 2 Mac release isn't done, we're just going to have to totally slip. They know their report goes up to all the people who manage all the other groups that they have dependencies with. So if they want to raise an issue, that's a great way to raise it. And if they don't raise it in the status report, and then 2 months later they say something, that's a breakdown in communication. The internal group is totally copied on those things, so it's sort of the consensus of the group. The status reports are brief and have a standard format. Gates can read most of them quickly and still spot potential project delays or changes he does not want, although some projects and issues get more attention than others. I read every one of those things. It's not that hard to read 100 status reports. If it's an obscure mail gateway product, and if it hasn't slipped a whole bunch, then I just hit delete. The thing is very succinct. It's like 2 screens full. There's a line for each date, like milestone dates, spec by dates, code complete dates, and then there's a column for the original date, the last date, and what they're reporting this time. Gates especially looks for schedule slips, cutting too many product features, or the need to change a specification. In any reporting period, there'll only be about 10 to 15 of them that catch my eye, because of comments like, several features were cut. Well, is there anything left? Give me a clue. Or, you know you just slipped the schedule. Not much of a comment. People really have to address size and speed requirements. Or when a competitor comes into the market with a new version, they have to really say in their status report, are they choosing to stay with the spec as it is, or are they going to change the spec and go with the new schedule? It's a really major thing to get that straight. The thing that jumps out right away is, are they changing the date this time? And so, As you read the development commentary, the program management commentary, the testing commentary, marketing commentary, which are usually only about 3 or 4 sentences each, sometimes there's a lot going on. Then you know you have that context in mind. It's easy then just to shoot off a piece of mail and say, "Come on, I thought I asked to get drag and drop into this thing, and I don't see it in the status report. And don't we need this thing? Didn't we promise this thing to HP? And what about the risk version? You don't mention that." But I'm not the only sanity checkpoint on these things. There's quite a few other people. Program reviews. Microsoft holds program review meetings for each project every 3 months or so. These meetings, lasting about 2 hours, are usually attended by Gates as well as other senior executives. Project teams send 1 or 2 key people from each functional area. Program management, the group responsible for writing down product specifications. Software development, the people who write the computer code. Software testing, the people who test the code. Product management, the people in charge of product planning and marketing. And user education, the group that prepares product documentation. Gates told us that he focuses on the same types of issues he looks for in the status reports. You want to know, is the project under control? That's fundamental. And you want to know if people are anticipating major problems. If they're adding something that could potentially slow the product down, you say to them, "Prove to me it's not going to be 10 times slower." If something is taking longer to get done than they expected, was it because they just didn't understand the design? You have to ask enough questions to really understand, are we on top of what we're doing? And you have to listen for ideas that have come up during the project that might be worth changing the spec to accommodate. Can they take something and push it to a higher level of generality? What's their relationship with all the other groups? I believe in code sharing across the groups. I've imposed on them the necessity to get this thing from this group and that thing from that group, and those groups don't work for them. If they want to point out to me some dependency that is creating massive bugs, or it's massively slow, or they may never get that piece from that group in time, it's important to bring that out in the discussion. If the marketplace environment has changed, and we're asking them to change the spec, it's important they hear from me about that. There's also a need to set a tone in terms of telling them they're doing super well or not doing super well once you have the data. Sometimes you have that before you go into a meeting because the amount of email that's generated about projects is rather massive. Stephen Sinofsky, Gates's technical assistant in 1993 and 1994, and now group program manager for Office, downplayed the drama of the program reviews, claiming that senior executives usually know about problems beforehand and hold preliminary meetings with the projects. It's just a chance to make sure they have their act together, and often they'll do them for Mike Maples or for Steve Ballmer previously, or for one of the senior VPs, and then they'll do them for Bill as well. It's not an ambush. But Gates does try to mix up his questions. He spends some time on obvious things and also probes more deeply. I'll always surprise people with maybe half my questions, but about half the questions are fairly clear. I can remind people of which benchmarks really count. I can remind people of which system configurations really count. In some cases, he sends in some help. At my level, what do I really control? I have some very senior developers that I could shift over onto a project and have them help me review the algorithms, mathematical or procedural recipes to accomplish particular tasks through computer code, review the code, or just pitch in. So if a project really appears to be broken, then you want an independent review of the code. Very early in the company, I'd say, "Hey, give me the source code. I'll take it home." I can't do that now. So I take somebody, a D14 or a D15, the top technical ranks in the company, and say, "Go dig into this thing and let me know," or help them out in terms of getting more personnel assigned. They're always going to have a recommendation in terms of what features ought to be cut, because they understand all the dependencies and how the pieces fit together. Gates admitted, however, that he finds it difficult to cancel projects in trouble. We don't have that many we cancel, but sometimes things will shift in the marketplace and we'll cancel. That's a combined technical business decision. The most famous one was the database we were doing. The first Windows database was inadequate. You could say we started over. Some people would say we only rewrote 80% of the thing, but it was fairly radical. And Word for Windows was a classic. If you want to take a project that was late, that's our most famous late thing. In reviewing specifications, Gates concentrates on a few key themes. He wants to know how exciting a new product is, as well as how it fits with other Microsoft products. Increasingly, he also asks about quality, mainly defined in terms of bug levels. These three issues drive Gates's recommendation on whether a product is good enough to ship. Another rising concern is making sure that groups cooperate and share common components, and that products slated to work together or share code are coordinated and on schedule. Managing such interdependencies is no trivial matter for Microsoft's previously independent product groups, and it is likely to become a greater problem, because many Microsoft products may now come out every year, for example, Windows 95 and Office 95. Delays beyond the control of any one project could force embarrassing changes in product names. Gates prefers to set broad directions and then leave the product groups to solve these types of problems on their own. But he continues to astonish people with his ability to grasp the technical details of what the groups are doing. This has happened with products outside his personal area of expertise, like Windows NT, but more commonly with products he understands from personal experience, like Basic, Word, and Excel. Mike Conti, formerly a product and program manager on Excel, and now with Office, recalled how the busy Gates took minutes to find a weakness in a new feature. The Excel team, which knew about the flaw but had not yet told Gates, had taken a month to find the problem. "We did a thing called subminimal recalculation in Excel 3.0. Minimal recalc says you only recalculate dependencies. Minimal recalc only recalcs the cells that were affected by the change you made, instead of recalcing the whole sheet. That was a big innovation for speed in recalc. For Excel 3.0, we did subminimal recalc, which said even in some cases you can skip the dependencies if the intermediate results haven't changed. And so we're talking about this to Bill, and he says, 'What about this case, this case, and this case?' And Chris Peters, who was our development manager at the time, said, 'Well, funny you mention those. After a month of thinking about this problem, those are the three cases we came up with. We were not optimal.'" So he's pretty good at following the technical stuff. Preparing for an encounter with Gates can be intimidating even to seasoned employees and executives. Chris Peters, now vice president of the Office product unit, gave this advice to his colleagues in his now famous 1990 video entitled "Shipping Software." "You should keep Bill very informed about what you're doing and why. You should never hide anything from Bill because he's so good at knowing everything. But you should be firm and you should yell back. The only recommendation I can bring or give you guys is to bring your very, very, very best developers with you to the meeting so they can quote things off the top of their head and they can just bury him with facts. Don't ever be unprepared, but say no. Bill respects no. Bill understands shipping on time. I think the thing that we finally said is it will be useful for Microsoft to know what it takes to ship a product on time, so please let us not do this feature. I think we ended up doing that feature, actually, but that's why he's Bill Gates." Control over new product development. To the question of what are the first things he let go of versus those he has insisted on controlling, Gates responded as follows. "Well, at first, I wouldn't let anybody write any code. I went in and took every statement that anybody else had written in Basic and rewrote it myself, just because I didn't like the way they coded. That product had a certain craftsmanship thing. I was very reluctant to let anybody get involved in it. But then we had products like Fortran and COBOL, where all I did was make sure that we were designing to the right spec and review the basic algorithms. I have not delegated the general idea of products to develop. I don't come in and say, "Well, I didn't know there's a whole new product group here. Nobody told me about that." That is a good decision for a CEO of a software company to keep in his hands. That's about the only one that I really control nowadays. A key role that Gates plays is to view the entire product portfolio of the company in light of the future directions he sees, including likely competitor moves. Then he makes the hard decisions, the technology versus business trade-offs. One example is how Gates, for 5 years, pushed for Excel and other groups to adopt Visual Basic as a common macro language. Macros are special commands that, at the user's discretion, combine many functions into one or two keystrokes. Using a standard macro language allows users to customize various Microsoft products, all in the same manner. Gates has also pushed groups to adopt object linking and embedding, OLE, standards, so that they can more easily share components. Gates also works closely with key projects. He helps define current products as well as chart future directions. As Ed Fries, development manager for Word, recalled, "We interact with Bill a lot, especially in the early stages of a product, when we're going over the spec and we're trying to decide what features we're going to put into the product. Bill was here a few weeks ago, and we walked him around and showed him all the stuff that we're doing in Word. He was on a Think Week last week, and during that week, he probably sent 10 pieces of mail to Chris Peters that said, 'Oh, here's something I don't like about this version of Word, and here's something you should be thinking about in the future to make spelling better for all our products. Or Word and Help, and how can those things be combined into one type of thing?' So Bill does a lot to define our future direction with the product, and he also does some quick criticism of where we are now. He always represents where he thinks things are going to be 5 years from now. We're trying to balance going in that direction with meeting the needs the users have today that we think we're not meeting. So we try to come up with a compromise of making that happen. That's always the conflict." With the fiercely independent culture of Microsoft managers and developers, however, it is rare that Gates tries to mandate anything. According to Sanofsky, "The numbers of those things are so small that they all have a reputation of their own." Along with pushing groups to adopt Visual Basic and OLE, some key additions to products that Gates has demanded include an outlining feature in Excel, tables and drag and drop in Word, and custom controls in Visual Basic, called VBXs. Gates also once insisted that program managers and developers use Visual Basic for writing prototypes and special software programs. Some groups successfully resisted when they found the language inappropriate for technical reasons. And Executive Vice President Steve Ballmer, with Gates's agreement, once mandated that Microsoft groups use a pre-ship version of Windows NT as their operating system, rather than Windows or OS 2. In addition, Gates told Microsoft's Commercial Tools Group, which makes language compilers, among other things, to add features to support Microsoft's internal software developers rather than just serve outside customers. Occasionally, Gates halts projects mired in delays and bugs, such as the Omega database product for Windows, which later evolved into Access. He has also consolidated projects working on multiple versions of the same type of function, such as text processing code, in Word, Excel, and Mail. People argue with Gates and his suggestions fairly often. As Chris Peters observed, this is necessary to gain his respect. But people must have clear technical grounds and data to support their positions. Arguments based on personal or emotional reasons or internal politics have little impact on Gates or other key managers. Gates in particular seems to need a new intellectual model, a comprehensive argument that views the world differently, in order to change his mind. As Stephen Sanofsky explained, "You can't repeat your argument over and over again if his model keeps refuting your argument. You need to find a new model that disproves his." Principle. Organize flexibly around and across product markets and business functions. Bill Gates insisted to us that Microsoft's dominant organizational theme is by products. We find this to be largely true, but Microsoft also pays a lot of attention to, albeit overlapping, technical or functional specialties. People in these jobs work in multifunctional teams organized by product, with some mechanisms to integrate across the product groups. Furthermore, in addition to divisions and product groups, Microsoft has two other organizational structures. One is formal, consisting of the management hierarchy. The second is informal. This consists of a loosely defined brain trust of executives and a network of technical people and managers who work on special assignments or projects, often at the suggestion of Bill Gates or other senior executives. Organizational and process evolution. Microsoft adopted its current organizational structure and process for product development in stages and through trial and error. During the early 1980s, it created an end-user group to develop applications programs. This allowed the systems and applications groups to evolve independently. The company struggled, however, to improve functional expertise, especially in testing. It also had to overcome problems stemming from a lack of focus in the product groups and relatively poor mechanisms for quality control and project management. As in many other companies, several turning points and key actors defined this evolution. The first turning point was a decision in 1984 to set up testing groups separate from development. This provided an independent check on the work of developers. The second, occurring about the same time, was when program management began to emerge as a function distinct from product management and software development. Third was a series of late and buggy products during the mid-1980s, which led to a growing consensus in the company that Microsoft had to become much more serious about quality control and project management. Microsoft groups now began documenting their experiences in projects through written postmortems, reflecting the belief that people could do a much better job at learning from mistakes. Fourth was the arrival of Mike Maples in 1988 from IBM and his decision to create smaller business units. These added more focus to the operating groups and made them easier to manage. The fifth key event was a 1989 retreat where top managers and developers grappled with how to reduce defects and proposed solutions that helped Microsoft teams become more systematic in software development and quality control. One was the idea of breaking up a project into sub-projects or milestones, which Publisher 1.0 did successfully in 1988. Another was to do daily builds of products, which several groups had done, but without enforcing the goal of zero defects. These critical ideas would become the essence of the sync and stabilize process. XL 3.0, developed in 1989 and 1990, was the first Microsoft project that was large in size and a major revenue generator to use the new techniques, and it shipped only 11 days late. A sixth key event was the 1992 establishment of the four-person Office of the President and the centralization of all product development responsibilities under Maples. These moves brought more structure to the operating systems groups, whose schedules remain difficult to predict. Seventh was a 1993 reorganization that centralized most product managers in marketing groups for the individual divisions, except for a few product planners who remained with the product development groups. Microsoft also renamed the business units product units to reflect this change, and it created the Office Product Unit. These changes have more clearly separated marketing from product planning and development, and they have facilitated sharing of common components across Microsoft's key applications products. The split of Microsoft into systems and applications divisions came under former Microsoft President John Shirley, an MIT dropout and Tandy Corporation Radio Shack executive whom Gates recruited in 1983. Gates had assumed developers should report to developers, not general managers, and that all development should report to him, since he was the top developer in the company. Gates also tried to control other key areas, such as marketing, an approach that quickly became obsolete as Microsoft grew beyond a handful of products. Shirley concluded that Gates had overstretched himself and that a reorganization was necessary. For example, Gates had a habit of pulling developers from one team and putting them on another, and making large changes in specifications with no prior warning or planning for such contingencies. Shirley felt the CEO should define products at a high level of abstraction and set strategic directions for the development organization, rather than be bogged down in the details of each project. Gates agreed to the reorganization and to limit himself to overseeing applications, and he put Steve Ballmer in charge of systems. Gates gave this account of the changes. "Before Mike Maples came in, all development worked for me, because there was this theory that developers should never have to work for somebody who couldn't write thousands of lines of code a day. It was just an insult to them. So all development management was purely developers, and at almost every step of the chain, there was a developer who had written more code, basically. Then I broke it into systems and applications, and I put Steve in charge of systems. Well, Steve is non-technical, but he's fairly mathematical, and he has a good personality. People trusted his ability when it came to a technical decision to turn to the right developers that, even though they weren't managers, were people that everyone had broad respect for. So we got by then." Microsoft decided in 1984 to separate testing from development after bugs in different products prompted complaints from hardware manufacturers who bundled Microsoft's operating systems with their PCs. Microsoft refers to these companies as original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs. For example, the version of BASIC that Microsoft shipped with the IBM PC in 1981 gave the wrong answer when the user divided 0.1 and other numbers by 10. After this incident, IBM insisted that Microsoft improve its processes for software development and quality control. Microsoft had other non-publicized problems in the early 1980s as well, such as a bug in its Fortran product, a technical programming language, that corrupted data. Individual customers also began complaining about quality problems in Microsoft's application products, which they could buy in retail stores. Senior managers finally saw the need to introduce better internal testing and quality control practices. There was resistance to this idea, since most programmers, and even some senior managers, such as Ballmer, insisted that developers could test their own products, assisted on occasion by high school students, secretaries, and some outside contractors. Microsoft did make a special effort by hiring the Arthur Anderson Consulting Firm to test its new version of the multi-plan spreadsheet for the Macintosh before it shipped in January 1984. But an outside company usually cannot test a complex software product adequately. A serious data-destroying bug forced Microsoft to ship an update to Mac Multiplan's 20,000 buyers at the cost of $10 each, $200,000 total. Microsoft managers concluded that they could not meet higher quality standards without setting up an independent testing group, following the lead of IBM and other companies with longer and more successful histories of software development. Dave Moore, Microsoft's director of development, recalled this realization. "We knew that we couldn't stand alone with development doing their own testing. We needed a separate group that could build the test, run the test, give some feedback to development. That was a turning point." Microsoft did not copy such IBM techniques as making large groups of people review all software items, from specifications documents to code and test plans, or requiring executives to sign off at the various development stages. These bureaucratic practices are common in software production for mainframe computers and defense applications, but they are still rare in the PC world. Nor did Microsoft start monitoring in detail how developers and testers spend their time, as IBM and a few other companies, including Japanese software factories, do. Instead, Microsoft people selected what seemed to be good techniques, such as separate testing group and automated tests, and code reviews for new people or critical components. Then they promoted these, not as IBM practices. That's not the way to get it used in Microsoft, noted Moore, but as methods that worked. But, Moore added, we did it wrong. After Microsoft expanded the new testing groups between 1984 and 1986, developers got lazy, thinking they could throw code over the wall to testing. They forgot that developers find more of their own bugs than testers do, and that only developers can prevent errors from happening in the first place. Meanwhile, Microsoft shipped the next big disaster in company annals. Word 3.0 for the Macintosh, delivered in February 1987, after having been promised for July 1986, had approximately 700 bugs, several of which destroyed data or crashed the program. Microsoft had to ship a free upgrade to customers within 2 months of the original release, costing more than $1 million. By now, it had become apparent, even to skeptics within the company, that Microsoft was having enormous difficulties managing product development, and that groups would have to become more systematic to satisfy customers. Gates himself took over the applications division, but several key projects remained in chaos. None of the new applications for Windows, except for Excel, were progressing. A database program, dubbed the Omega Project, which evolved into Access, and a project management application for Windows, were in serious trouble. The Opus Project, later renamed Word for Windows, caused staffers to coin the now famous phrase, infinite defects. This describes a situation where testers are finding bugs faster than developers can fix them, and each fix leads to yet another bug. Under these conditions, predicting the schedule and eventual ship date becomes impossible. This sometimes occurred at Microsoft when summer interns wrote code and then went back to college without testing their work fully, and when developers moved from one feature or project to another, also without fully testing their work. During the late and large integration and testing periods that Microsoft used to attempt, developers had to return to old code whose details they had largely forgotten or whose authors had disappeared. In rewriting much of the code to fix the innumerable bugs, the developers tended to add as many new errors as they repaired. Roger Sherman, Microsoft's director of testing, recalled this dark period in Microsoft's history. People got the message that they actually could screw up. It's like driving a race car. They hit the wall, and now they know where the wall is. People learned that they couldn't just throw code together, no matter how imaginative or how creative. They had to look at some things, external factors, and they had to have code that was testable, and testing resources were not infinite. They had to work on stable code. So, from the negative experience of Omega and Opus, people learned something that pushed them into this milestone process. I think the lessons were probably learned better in Access than they were in Word. The bug databases were so large, they couldn't keep them on a single server. There were so many active bugs that the test team really didn't have any work to do. Why bother? Development has 2 years' worth of work backlog to catch up with us already. So they spent all their time automating and developing automation tools. Finally, somebody said, "These ship dates are totally unrealistic. The project is a mess. We're never going to be able to ship this on time." And that probably means that the whole definition of the product is bogus as well. And so they had to go back and take small portions of the product and stabilize them. They cut a lot of the product away and got back to a point where they had a stable code base and were able to proceed. Rather than let more projects spin out of control, Gates decided to go outside the company for more management expertise. In July 1988, he brought in Mike Maples, who had been with IBM for 23 years and headed software strategy and business evaluation. He was also a central figure in the development of OS2 and Presentation Manager, an early graphical interface product for the IBM PC. Ironically, Microsoft people often criticized IBM for hiring too many programmers who were not very skilled developers, a practice they referred to disparagingly as masses of asses programming, and using a development process that was too sequential and compartmentalized. Microsoft managers also believed that IBM required thousands of people to do what Microsoft could achieve with just a few hundred top-notch developers. But Maple seemed uniquely talented, and Gates wanted to see more processes in place to make sure Microsoft built and delivered its products and controlled their quality more effectively. A key 1989 memo summarizing discussions from the May retreat, which Dave Moore organized, galvanized the product groups to take corrective actions. The memo, titled Zero Defects Code and written by Chris Mason, a development manager in the Word Group, reflected the state of affairs and the new process Microsoft would adopt. Microsoft Memo to Application Developers and Testers from Chris Mason. Date 6/20/89. Subject Zero Defects Code. CC Mike Maples, Steve Ballmer, Applications Business Unit Managers, and Department Heads. On May 12th and 13th, the Applications Development Managers held a retreat with some of their project leads, Mike Maples, and other representatives of applications and languages. My discussion group investigated techniques for writing code with no defects. This memo describes the conclusions which we reached. There are a lot of reasons why our products seem to get buggier and buggier. It's a fact that they're getting more complex, but we haven't changed our methods to respond to that complexity. The point of enumerating our problems is to realize that our current methods, not our people, cause their own failure. Our scheduling methods and Microsoft's culture encourage doing the minimum work necessary on a feature. When it works well enough to demonstrate, we consider it done, everyone else considers it done, and the feature is checked off the schedule. The inevitable bugs months later are seen as unrelated. When the schedule is jeopardized, we start cutting corners. The reason that complexity breeds bugs is that we don't understand how the pieces will work together. This is true for new products, as well as for changes to existing products. I mean this literally. Your goal should be to have a working, nearly shippable product every day. Since human beings themselves are not fully debugged yet, there will be bugs in your code no matter what you do. When this happens, you must evaluate the problem and resolve it immediately. Coding is the major way we spend our time. Writing bugs means we're failing in our major activity. Hundreds of thousands of individuals and companies rely on our products. Bugs can cause a lot of lost time and money. We could conceivably put a company out of business with a bug in a spreadsheet, database, or word processor. We have to start taking this more seriously. Over in the systems area, Microsoft was also having severe troubles with Windows. As Gates's biographers observed after Microsoft shipped the third version of Windows in 1990, the product was still far from perfect. Once again, Microsoft's testers had not weeded out all the problems. There were problems installing the program on certain machines, troubles with networks, difficulties with the pointing device called a mouse, data destruction with certain third-party disk management software, along with the usual collection of glitches and documentation errors. The running gag in the industry was that Microsoft products were in beta test until version 3. Gates and many other Microsoft people had additional worries. Stock options had become a critical source of compensation in the company, and delayed products more than occasionally brought the price of Microsoft stock crashing down. Delays and recalls also confused and frustrated customers, both on the OEM and retail sides. There was even a shareholder suit due to Microsoft's failure to ship Word, which then accounted for 20% of sales, that the company settled in 1990 for $1.5 million. The suit charged that Microsoft managers concealed their knowledge of the delay. As for the database project, it was supposedly 3 months from being finished when Mike Maples arrived in 1988. A year and a half later, he and Gates canceled it. These continuing problems in both the applications and systems divisions created a receptive environment for Maples to suggest changes. In particular, he wanted smaller groups that worked in projects targeting specific leading competitors and products, such as WordPerfect, Lotus 123, and Harvard Graphics. He also wanted each of these groups to define and then refine their processes for software development, testing, and project management. After discussing the matter with Gates, Maples broke down the applications division into five business units: Office, Analysis, Excel, Graphics, PowerPoint, Data Access, and Entry, Works. These now became independent profit centers, with self-contained resources for program management, development, testing, marketing, product management and product planning, and user education, very much patterned after the highly successful independent business unit that IBM used to launch its original PC in 1981. Maples, who got his introduction to Gates and Microsoft while working for this IBM unit, recalled his influence on Microsoft's reorganization. "It was really funny. When I first came, I went to what we called resource planning meetings. The head of development, the head of marketing, the head of program management, and the head of testing would be there, and they'd go over a project. Every week, every project would move. Some of them that were out 18 months would move their target date for completion 3 days. And then they'd say, 'Okay, we need more testers on this project.' So we'd rip some testers off something and put them on another project. And then the next week we'd have another resource planning meeting, and the one we took them off of was in trouble, so we'd move them. It was constant moving people around. People never owned projects. Then we built this whole idea of the business units. Conceptually, you lose the efficiency of moving people around. The testing group for Word stays the testing group for Word, even when there isn't anything to test. But it turns out that knowing what the continuity is in your resource pool allows you to plan. And that also did quite a bit in growing a lot of management people by giving people a lot broader responsibility. It brought a great deal of focus to customers and sets of competitors. By and large, Microsoft is broadly organized that way now in terms of small business units. Microsoft maintained this same basic organizational structure with some refinements. In 1992, Gates moved Steve Ballmer from head of the systems division to head of the sales and support group. He also created an expanded worldwide products group, with Mike Maples overseeing product development for both applications and systems areas. This change gave Maples a chance to rein in the operating systems groups until he retired in 1995, at which time Microsoft once again separated responsibilities for applications and operating systems. In 1993, Microsoft also centralized marketing and created the Office Product Unit. In addition, Microsoft appointed directors for the key functional areas: development, testing, program management, and user education. Since 1994, this staff group reports to an overall director of product development. The directors do not oversee projects or have well-defined responsibilities, although they help groups identify and share best practices. Gates reflected on the pluses and minuses of the new organization. "It's a trade-off. All organizational things are a trade-off. It optimizes for the esprit de corps of the product. What are we trying to do with this product? What trade-offs do we need to make with this product? Did we ship a product? Did it win the review?" And so it breaks down the idea of specialization. There are two big drawbacks to the product organization. One is that, with any skill area, it's not as obvious that best practices, interviewing practices, new tools, new approaches, get shared as well. And if you take the extreme group, like a group that has one tester, how are they supposed to review that tester and tell him, "Hey, you didn't read the latest book on testing"? And so we lay over a very small group of people that are supposed to make sure testing knows all the new things going on. But it's just a very small part. And second, it makes it hard to share code. but it's far, far better to do it that way. If we had tried over the last 8 years not to use business units to do our stuff, this thing would break down. A clear benefit of Microsoft's organization is that it provides the freedom for groups to operate as relatively small development centers, totally dedicated to shipping products to particular markets. As Chris Peters explained, the business units, although we pretend that they're mini companies, are really pure product development centers. There is no sales or finance. All that stuff is removed from it. Everybody in a business unit has exactly the same job description, and that is to ship products. Your job is not to write code. Your job is not to test. Your job is not to write specs. Your job is to ship products. You're trying not to write code. If we could make all this money by not writing code, we'd do it. Stimulated in particular by the 1989 retreat, Microsoft managers also now insist that developers and testers stay in their groups for more than one product cycle. They want developers to make more effort to get it right the first time and to build in quality. Microsoft's strategy for doing this is to use the daily build and multiple milestone techniques, the essence of the sync and stabilize process we describe in chapters 4 and 5. Current management structure and organization. Microsoft's current management hierarchy, below the board of directors, begins with the communal leadership, first instituted in 1992, the Office of the President. After a July 1995 reorganization following the retirement of Mike Maples, this includes, in addition to Bill Gates as Microsoft's chairman and chief executive officer, five senior managers who direct Microsoft's four operating groups. Group Vice Presidents Nathan Myhrvold, formerly head of Advanced Technology, and Pete Higgins, formerly head of Desktop Applications, jointly preside over the new Applications and Content Group. Group Vice President Paul Moritz, formerly responsible for Product and Technology Strategy, heads the new Platforms Group. These two groups build Microsoft's products and conduct research and development. Executive Vice President Steve Ballmer is in charge of the Sales and Support Group, while Robert Herbold is head of the Operations Group and also serves as Chief Operating Officer. Reporting to these group executives are Division Vice Presidents and General Managers. Below them are Product Unit Managers, followed by Functional Team Managers, and then Team Leads in the Product Groups. The Applications and Content Group has four divisions: Desktop Applications, Consumer, Online Systems, and Research. The Platforms Group also has four divisions: Personal Operating Systems, Business Systems, Developer and Database Systems, and Advanced Consumer Systems. Most of these divisions contain their own marketing departments staffed by product planners and share a centralized usability lab staffed by 30 to 35 people to test features and product prototypes. The Sales and Support Group has separate divisions for worldwide OEM sales, primarily to AST, DEC, Dell, Compaq, Fujitsu, Gateway, IBM, NEC, Olivetti, Packard Bell, Toshiba, Unisys, and Zenith. Product Support Services, abbreviated as PSS, International Operations, mainly Asia, Advanced Technology Sales, Strategic Enterprise Systems, Special Sales and Consulting to Large Firms, North American Sales, and European Sales. The Operations Group includes Finance, Diskette Production, Manuals and Book Publishing, Microsoft Press, Information Systems, and Human Resource Management. Within the Platforms Group, the Personal Operating Systems Division produces Windows and MS-DOS. The Business Systems Division produces Windows NT and Object Linking and Embedding, OLE, with a separate product unit for workgroup applications, electronic mail, and PC server systems. The Developer and Database Systems Division builds programming languages such as Visual Basic, programming support tools, and database products such as Access and FoxPro. The Advanced Consumer Systems Division contains groups for interactive TV systems and broadband communications and multimedia technologies. Within the Applications and Content Group, the Desktop Applications Division contains the Office Product Unit. This supervises the Word and Excel product units and works closely with the Graphics Product Unit, PowerPoint, to make sure that these three products function together properly in the Office application suite. The division also builds Project, a popular project management tool. The consumer division includes the Microsoft Home product groups, which build the Money Home Finance product, as well as multimedia applications for home entertainment and education, and a combination word processor, spreadsheet, and database product for novices called Works. The Online Systems Division develops and manages the new Microsoft Network. Research explores new product and programming technologies and works closely with various product groups. Divisions contain more than one product unit. Each product unit generally has five functional teams run by a separate manager: program management, development, testing, product planning, product managers assigned to the product groups, and user education. Microsoft breaks down these teams into areas related to the products they build. For example, before the formation of the Office Product Unit, developers in the Excel unit had five small teams: Recalc Functions, Charting, Printing Formatting, Add-ins, special software programs, often imported from outside, such as for statistical analysis or spell checking, and Macros Conversions. Some product units combine their teams for user education, which prepare manuals and online documentation, such as help functions. In the Desktop Applications Division, the Office Product Unit's user education team prepares manuals for Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Also, the development groups generally include small teams that work with overseas subsidiaries to prepare non-English product versions. And product management groups have international managers that coordinate foreign marketing. Microsoft KK, a Japanese subsidiary that creates Japanese, Chinese, and Korean versions of desktop applications, reports directly to the division manager. About 30%, 5,100, work overseas in 36 foreign subsidiaries responsible for sales, product support, and some adaptation work into local languages. Overseas accounts for nearly 70% of Microsoft's retail sales. Of the 13,300 employees in the United States, there are approximately 1,850 software developers, 1,850 software test engineers, and 400 program managers and product planners. Some 2,100 people work in customer support, 4,000 in sales, marketing, and consulting, 600 in user education, 2,200 in operations and administration, and 300 in research. The bigger product units, such as Office, Windows NT, and Windows, each have between 300 and 400 people, and several other product units have 200 or more people. Groups building operating systems tend to have more developers and testers than applications groups. The latter need more people in product planning and program management, since their features are more directly visible and marketed to non-technical customers. Overall, these numbers represent enormous increases over the past decade. Groups such as Excel, Word, and MS-DOS Windows had 10 or fewer developers in the early 1980s, and only a few dozen total employees. Other divisions have seen similar increases. The product support services staff has grown from a couple of dozen people in the early 1980s to a couple of thousand today, and it has become an invaluable source of feedback to the product development groups. Microsoft's highly effective sales and marketing force has also grown from a handful of people a decade ago to approximately 3,000. This number includes hundreds of consultants that help corporations install databases and network systems. Sales and marketing, including advertising, are Microsoft's largest expenses, equal to about 30% of 1994 revenues. Operating costs, including product support, consumed about 15% of 1994 revenues. Research and development, treated as a current expense, 13%, and general administrative costs, 3%. This left Microsoft with about 37% of its revenues as profits before taxes. Rapid rises in R&D, sales and marketing, and product support expenses, however, have prompted Gates, Maples, and other senior managers to seek ways to reduce these costs, such as through more systematic engineering practices, better coordination among the product groups, and improved product quality and ease of use to cut down on the need for customer support. Rising interdependencies among the product groups, as well as the growth in product size and complexity, and the need to always maintain compatibility with previous versions of a product, remain difficult problems to manage. At times, these problems have tarnished Microsoft's efforts to deliver reliable products on a more predictable schedule. As we discuss later, delays in shipping Office 4.0 and Windows 95 are typical of the difficulties Microsoft has been struggling to overcome. Old rivalries, systems versus applications. The most significant aspect of the 1992 change in the top management structure is that it formally unified responsibility for the systems and applications divisions, as in the days when projects reported directly to Gates. This move placed both divisions under Mike Maples. It was important to bring these two divisions closer together because of their long-standing rivalries and growing strategic interdependence. Understanding in depth how Windows products work is essential to writing good applications. Influencing the evolution of Windows and technologies such as OLE is equally important to writing good applications, and new systems products like Windows NT will never take hold in the marketplace if applications builders, led by Microsoft, do not write applications. The problem is that, historically, Microsoft's systems and applications divisions have never gotten along very well. Systems people, especially the group that has built Windows 3.1 and Windows 95, have also tended to be less organized and less systematic than their counterparts in applications, even though systems products are usually more difficult to build and test. Maples succeeded in getting the applications groups to become more systematic and quality-oriented, and he tried to do the same with the systems groups while these were under his direction until 1995. Managers such as Dave Cutler, who joined Microsoft from DEC, had similar values, but Maples did not succeed completely. He acknowledged to us that his focus on customer problems and process was more suitable for applications than for system software, for two basic reasons. First, operating systems have to run on many different kinds of unique hardware. To test the various kinds of hardware requires very long, extensive, large-volume betas, tests of preliminary product versions at customer sites, so that users can try many different combinations of machine and application configurations. Progress for this kind of testing is difficult to predict. Second, Maples observed that operating systems projects are generally much larger in terms of people, and they have components that interact with many different products. These make project management much more cumbersome. One of the things that can make apps efficient is that they can have a small team, communicate well, and have fewer dependencies. Systems has lots more dependencies, bigger teams. It is a different process. I would say, not as a value judgment, but as just kind of a fact, that the apps guys are more process-driven than the systems guys. As a result, there is usually what some people have described as a greater level of chaos in the systems division, including the high-profile Windows 95 project. Windows NT is somewhat of an exception, as Maples noted. In systems, we have very different processes. Dave Cutler in the NT group is very, very regimented. They have a workbook and write everything down, a very strict, strong type of process, whereas in Windows and DOS, it's much more of a gunslinger process. You know, let's kind of start coding and see how it works out. But Maples believed that all the systems groups needed to show more concern with controlling defects and improving accuracy in predicting when they would finish. Various managers with experience on both sides of the fence confirmed this view of systems as more problematic than applications, although this distinction is changing slowly. Chris Peters, who worked as a developer on MS-DOS 2.0 and Windows 1.0, as well as on various versions of Excel and Word, before becoming vice president of Office, emphasized the lack of control in specifications and project management. Systems, you'll find, is far less organized than the apps group. I don't think they have proper specs. They'll say, yes, we use milestones, but you'll say, how many milestones total in the project? And they won't be able to tell you. Richard Barth, a senior product manager for Windows NT, agreed. When I first came in 1990, there really was a pretty vast gulf between applications and systems in the way they were managed. In fact, from the system side, we often looked at the application side and thought of them as much better managed, that the development process was much more under control there. One of the reasons for the different culture in the systems division has been the management style of Steve Ballmer. For years, he preferred a relatively unstructured environment, with no separate testing function and lots of freedom for program managers and developers to innovate and make changes in the product late in the development cycle. Dave Moritz, formerly head of testing for MS-DOS and Windows, and now retired from Microsoft, had this to say about Ballmer, his former boss. He's very sharp, but it's very hard to work under Steve because he was so random. He's not a structured type of guy. That's why he was moved out of controlling systems. Mike Conti, senior program manager in the Office group, suggested another reason for the different culture in systems. I think that one of the shifts they're still making is away from an OEM-focused perspective to an end-user-focused perspective. It's partly history and culture. Steve Ballmer was very much the leader of that division. He's not somebody who is structured or bureaucratic, and it just didn't evolve over there. Also, it's because they tend to be more technical. The developers tend to have more of a say, and developers, without structure, are reasonably irrational. Left to their own devices, they will do things which may not make sense for marketing reasons, or supportability, or anything else. So they haven't yet got straightened out. The applications division used to be kind of Wild West, too. Then Mike Maples had a real positive effect on rationalizing a lot of things. They haven't yet had that effect. This is an apps guy's perspective, so you've got to take it with a grain of salt. But he, Ballmer, can still rattle people's cages all over the company if he wants to, so he still has an effect over systems, and he has Bill's ear. And Mike is a very long game player. He's not the type of guy to go up there and say, okay, scorch the earth. We're going to do it my way. He's much more subtle than that. I think his plan